I'm going to give a talk today about emotion, and as I was saying earlier, it has no formulas in it. Hopefully, hopefully that's okay. By training, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I've been coming here for a few years and been involved in Perceptual Expertise Network, I think, a year before that. And every time I go to these, I'm constantly thinking about the clinical psych applications for this, for the kinds of things I learn about here, these amazing things I learn about here. And the talk I'm giving is sort of a summary of, in my mind, of some of the most relevant points of intersection between learning and areas of what I guess you would call psychopathology, which includes autism. A lot of my work is in autism, but also depression and anxiety, which have clear effects on learning. So, okay, so the main objective of this talk is to talk about theory and some data on how emotion is related to cognitive processes that I think are going to be near and dear to at least some of you. And real simple, there's two parts. There's a theory part and a data part. Here's the theory part. A little minimalist here. So real quick, just to review what I mean when I talk about emotion, it's a hypothetical construct in the classic sense. You can't smell it, you can't touch it, you can't taste it. You infer its existence from intervening variables. Usually it's someone in your face, or reading someone's body language, or nowadays you can measure it using psychophysiology, imaging. This is, you know, it's probably better to talk about what emotion is over a beer or two. You might actually might get it a better answer, but here's a dry one that is sort of this definition here is kind of just an amalgam of a lot of definitions you see in affective neuroscience. It's, what is emotion? It's a system for coordinating cognitive and biological functions towards a desired goal or away from a painful one. I use the word painful here. You could probably slot in different words, but I like painful, whether it's emotionally painful or physically painful. The emotion system is geared towards getting us away from things that are painful. Never. I've never found myself led astray by my emotions personally. And so, you know, clinical psychologists don't have that problem. So, so the main point I want to make here is this is actually what, you know, we talk about hot and cold cognition in some areas of psychology. This definition is pretty cold. It encompasses a lot of functions and a lot of cognitive processes. Many of them have to do with learning as well. It's a broad umbrella here. I tend to be a lumper, not a splitter, and I'm going to do a lot of lumping here. So just to drive this point home, if you look at depression and anxiety, if you look at just the DSM-4 definitions of depression and anxiety disorders, you see cognition all over the place, and you see arousal all over the place. And that's just in the definitions. If you go into the literatures, you see much more about cognitive processes involved in depression and anxiety. And just to give an example, you know, the first three here mostly have to do with arousal and motivation. But if you look at this, let's see if this works. Diminished ability to think or concentrate. Sounds awfully cognitive. Now, it's funny, there's a sense in which why would that be under depression, a definition of depression? And I think it's probably intuitive to most people. I think the rates of a major depressive episode are something like 50% for all people. So half the people in this room at some point in their lives are going to have a major depressive episode, and you have a hard time thinking. And I think there's concrete reasons for that. Okay, so anxiety disorders are a broader range. I'm going to talk about what some of them are. But again, you see cognitive processes all over the place. GAD is generalized anxiety disorder. This is what we call the wheel of misfortune. This is when people who just every step in the day is a new opportunity to get screwed over and run into trouble. Oh, I'm going to lose my job. Oh, I know I'm joking about it, but you could probably relate to pieces of it. Generalized anxiety disorder is a process of being consumed by worry. It's hard to concentrate and it's hard to learn when you're in that state. Obsessive compulsive disorder is all about this game of chasing your thoughts. It's at a very meta level, but it's all about trying to actively use your executive functions, perhaps, to try to get a handle on different thought processes, sort them out, organize them in ways that ultimately wind up being self-defeating. Post-traumatic stress disorder here we get to the concept of arousal, which I'm going to talk about more, but again, difficulty concentrating right there. So, and this is just the DSM. This isn't the research literatures on these things. All right, so a little bit more theory. There's a pretty nice convergence in the field of depression and anxiety around certain specific models of what they are. Depression and anxiety co-occur all the time. The co-occurrence rate is something like 50% in the neighborhood as well. And there's a reason for that. What they share in common is this idea of negative affect, this valence dimension. In fact, there's some theories that suggest negative affect is sort of a diathesis, and whether you wind up depressed or anxious simply has to do with whether you're hyper-aroused. People with anxiety tend to be in a state of hyper-arousal. There's some variance among the anxiety disorders in this regard, but this is what makes you anxious. And usually, you don't see that in depression. You don't always see low arousal in depression. There's more variance there, but you certainly, if you take a severely depressed person with something like psychomotor retardation, that's a classic example of low arousal. So this is a pretty widely adopted model, and one of the main reasons I bring it up is learning, right? Jürgstad's law, 100 years old, this idea that people have an optimal level of arousal to engage and complete certain tasks. If the optimal level varies from task to task. If your goal is to, you know, run away from a lion who's chasing you, it's probably good to be hyper-aroused. You don't want to be calm. That's not cool. But if you're planning a meeting or organizing, you want to at least be, you know, optimally aroused and maybe in a low arousal state. If you're giving a talk, you know, all about giving a talk and dealing with that anxiety is trying to bring yourself as a speaker from here to here, right? The sweet spot. So this isn't part of why I think this is relevant to a lot of what we're doing is that a lot of my interest is in anxiety more than depression, so you're going to see that come up more in this talk, but rates of diagnoses of an anxiety disorder lifetime in kids is somewhere between 10 and 20%. This is just a breakdown. That doesn't mean at any given moment, you know, if you go into a classroom, 1 out of 5 kids is going to have an anxiety disorder, but over a lifespan, it's pretty significant. There's some variance among the disorders. You tend to see more panic disorder in adults than kids. There are various reasons for that. So this comes up, for those of you that are involved in education, I mean, this comes up all the time. It's really hard to work with undergraduates who are struggling with depression, let alone kids in grade school. Okay, so now I'm going to get to brain stuff. I'm going to drill down a bit more specifically. There's some really neat areas of research that have been emerging about the interface between emotion, cognition, and perception. And there are a lot of things I could talk about. I picked two because I thought they're the most relevant to us here. Ways in which emotion processes, air quotes, can influence other sorts of cognitive processes and perceptual processes that we study here. So the first example I'm going to talk about is literature to suggest that emotions may have some role in tuning perceptual processes. Now, I'll try not to overuse the air quotes. Tune is sort of it's actually a very interesting area of study, what exactly the mechanism is behind all this. But we know, for example, that the amygdala has reciprocal connections to areas of the temporal lobes, and there's some sort of influence going on there. It can happen very rapidly. There's some studies to suggest that there are these low roads or fast tracks to getting information to the amygdala, for example. And then this plays out over time. You know, it's interesting talking about the temporal dynamics. I guess I'm the turtle. I care about the kid over a year, which is my own bias, but or in the case of autism, over many years of experience not being interested in faces. All right, so I'm going to give you some examples of that. And then I'm going to talk about attention and executive function, which interestingly, I think is the most, if you're talking about cognition and emotion being somehow integrated, I feel like that's the middle ground in some respects. And there are a lot of new theories emerging about the role of prefrontal cortex in modulating more classic emotion structures, and possibly vice versa. So, all right, so now data. I like presenting this slide, Isabel. Is this resonating? This is what an fMRI figure looked like in the late 90s. And I just had to put it up here. I remember, what's that? I know, but As you should, rightly so. I remember printing out this. So, all right. Yeah, I have lots of memories. I'll just say this. I won't say it. This is back at Yale. Isabel was there, and I was an RA there. I guess I'm old enough to be happy to show how like little I am. I was an RA, and Bob was there, and I remember printing this out on a dye sublimation printer that was $1,500. They didn't even have color laser jets, right? Or inkjets. All right, anyway. Well, I actually have to explain what this is. Okay, so in autism, sorry, I'm going to reminisce for a second. One of the more interesting findings in visual cortex processing in autism is decreased activity in the fusiform gyrus. I imagine most of you are probably up to speed on this. It's a part of the brain involved in face processing. This is a finding from Bob and Isabel over 10 years ago, and it's been replicated a number of times. And since then, one of the interesting questions you can ask is why? Why would folks with autism show decreased activity in this part of the brain? Either, you know, one, to be very reductionistic about it, you can imagine some core pathology in this piece of tissue, or perhaps it's part of a network of things going wrong, or what? And one of the theories that gets discussed is one that has to do with social motivation. So I'm blazing through some things here. I haven't given much of an intro about what autism is, but all of you are probably aware. It has to do with social disconnection, this idea that one of the core features of autism is this disinterest in difficulty processing social information. And folks like Bob Schultz and Jerry Dawson have, over the past 10 years, put forward theories about social motivation and how that might play out developmentally. And one of these theories is that from a very early age, kids with autism are not interested in faces. This is one of the amazing things about having a little you know, kid who's a few weeks old or a few months old. They're so interested in faces. They become so interested in faces. Now you can imagine that what would happen if you didn't attend to faces, if you weren't interested, over a period of years, that may result in sort of diminished development of some of these visual cortex areas. And there is a neurobiological model that kind of, one model at least, that sits behind that. It's this idea that say you look at a face, and it doesn't have to be emotional, but I like this one. It's like five different emotions in one, so that's pretty cool. So, you know, one of the first things that happens perceptually, as we know, the information from this face gets to primary visual cortex and then follows the ventral stream to fusiform gyrus. This is a schematic, of course, for more further processing, and then we it's pretty clear that there are inputs from there into the amygdala. And what's become more interesting is this idea that the amygdala may send reentrant information along visual cortex, that the amygdala may actually send information to visual cortex. What that information is a very interesting question, and what exactly tune means is an interesting question, but there are anatomical models in place to support this. And a few years ago, one of the things I was interested in is actually finding evidence for this bidirectional communication between fusiform gyrus and amygdala. Excuse me. At that point, it was clear that the fusiform gyrus was sending inputs to the amygdala in the process of face processing, but the reverse connection had less evidence. So, in this study I'm going to talk about now, I was gunning for evidence that actually the amygdala is talking to the visual cortex as well as visual cortex sending information to the amygdala. And I did that in an fMRI study. Using 39 folks who are undergrads doing a basic face test, the kind of thing that a number of people have probably done here, 5-minute face localizer. And I use something called dynamic causal modeling, which is it's sort of a cousin of structural equation modeling. The idea is you construct different models of connections between things you care about, and you do colloquially sort of horse race. You see which one best fits your data, and you use various statistics to determine that. It's kind of a controversial technique in fMRI. Inevitably, you have to ask yourself when you're scanning every 2 seconds, how could you tell if a connection is going from A to B or B to A? Part of why I did this study was to see if this would work, and so it did, and I'll show you what I mean. So I tested 6 models in this study, 6 causal models of connectivity between fusiform gyrus and amygdala. One of them said, okay, fusiform inputs to the amygdala. One of them says, amygdala inputs to the fusiform, and then one says both. And then for these 3 different models, I tested whether it was modulated by the presence of faces doing a face recognition task. And that was the model that won, the one that was bidirectional, modulated by faces. So it what the data suggested was there was increased bidirectional communication between amygdala and fusiform gyrus when you were processing faces. And the various statistics, information criteria, and whatnot to, at play in coming up with this. But the bottom line is that for both left and right hemispheres, this of these six possible models, the one that was bidirectional won the day. So an emotion area influencing vision. We'll see exactly where that leads. It's a very interesting concept. The implication for learning, and this may resonate for Jim, it's this idea that we're having kids play games that we hope, kids with autism play games that we hope will improve their face processing skills, among other things. They could work because, again, to be reductionist about it, maybe we're tweaking the tissue, right? We're making this part of the brain sort of function better by, you know, through practice. It's possible. It's also possible that we're getting kids more motivated to pay attention, and that in a way getting better or more acclimated to handling faces has a downstream consequence of being better, more expert at them, being better able to process them. So if you care about the emotion piece, maybe you'll learn more about the perceptual piece. Oh, and a corollary of that is there's some evidence to suggest that folks with autism actually, some folks may have an aversion to facial information. And then again, the sort of process is in the same, but in the other direction. Perhaps these games reduce some of that aversion, if you will. And then again, kids will be more prone to handle faces, and then from there, processing improves. Okay, so this is kind of a change of gears. So that's one story. So that's story number one about emotion affecting stuff we care about. Here's story number two, which is the prefrontal cortex has a lot of, there are a lot of data that suggest a number of areas of prefrontal cortex that play some role in emotion, just as executive functioning, attentional control, and topics like that. Where it is and how constrained they are to particular regions is pretty actively discussed. But this is some work I was doing. This is actually a study following up on EEG findings. One of the older EEG findings of depression going back 30 years or so was that folks with depression had an abnormal pattern of EEG alpha asymmetry in their frontal lobes. It was biased towards the left hemisphere. The question I asked in this study was, can we find where in the left hemisphere this is happening? And I didn't do EEG in this study, but this study happened to involve an emotional Stroop task, a basic emotion manipulation done on a group of people who had anhedonic depression, which basically means a Venn diagram, they were just in the depressed piece. They didn't have anxiety. So it becomes important to parse these things out, individual differences when you're doing these things. And it was localized to dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And again, you know, you could think of Pat Goldman-Rakish going back, how you know, this is an exact goal-oriented executive functioning area we've known about for a long time, and it's functioning abnormally in depression. Okay, so now hopefully I'm going to change gears again, not too fast. But I care about prefrontal cortex regulation of amygdala, and it plays out in a number of different contexts. Another thing about autism that I don't think gets discussed enough is the prevalence of what you can classify as anxiety symptoms among folks with autism. This is a review of studies, and I love presenting this slide because it's sort of ridiculous. 84%, so these are estimates of the prevalence of anxiety disorders among people with autism. There's a variety of studies. You know, they go, it's a really big range, 11 to 84%. Might as well just call it a day and say 0 to 100%. Right? a lot of the variance there has to do with, well, ultimately it has to do with what you're calling anxiety and autism and how you're assessing it. We know that there are all kinds of comorbidities in autism. This is actually probably a big one. It's more prevalent in autism than it is in other intellectual disabilities as well as developmental disabilities. And so one of the things we've been studying at CHOP and at Penn is how common it is. So this is a study I did last year where we took an unselected sample of folks with autism, and we spent a good couple hours talking with them about anxiety symptoms, which is very interesting because a lot of the parents of these kids they're used to talking about, you know, their kids having meltdowns or having sort of behavioral issues, but we actually spent a couple hours talking about their thoughts and feelings using a structured interview. And lo and behold, we found high rates of, there's a lot of comorbidity, so you can fall in multiple bins here, but if you look at different variations of anxiety, We found it all over the place. And incidentally, we found SAD is separation anxiety, which you might not expect in autism, and it's a much longer conversation about what that actually means, what separation means to a kid with autism. But we found a lot of anxiety. And I've always been perplexed by something in autism, in the amygdala. So there are a lot of theories that implicate amygdala dysfunction in autism. In the general assumption is that it's somehow functionally switched off, and that can kind of explain why folks with autism are withdrawn, socially withdrawn. But okay, so the amygdala is involved in anxiety, and it's usually high among people with anxiety. That's pretty clear. Folks with autism have low amygdala function, but high anxiety doesn't quite fit. You with me? So one of the things I've been doing is trying to see how much emotion matters in these folks with autism when doing a basic face processing task. So looking at amygdala function, this is a sample of 43 kids with autism. And I'm going to go very quickly through this, but the bottom line is 5 minutes face localizers, they're unlike anything I've ever worked with in terms of fMRI paradigms. You just get really nice, it's amazing. You know, I studied prefrontal cortex 10 years ago, and you'd be lucky if, you know, 5 out of 20 people had activity in the area you cared about, but you get it all the time in amygdala and fusiform gyrus with just a 5 minute face localizer. So anyway, if you correlate the, so the SCARED is just a screening inventory for anxiety symptoms that's commonly used in kids. If you look at some of the different subdomain scores, you find correlations, positive correlations between anxiety symptoms and amygdala signal, exactly what you would predict from the anxiety disorder population. And this is something that, this is my sort of bias, but I feel like the autism community that studies amygdala has really overlooked. If you think about emotion, you start thinking about these things differently. And then we're looking at prefrontal cortex amygdala relationships using, in this case, it's diffusion-weighted imaging. There's some specific routes that we think prefrontal cortex modulates amygdala. And these are just some data in a larger sample of folks with autism to suggest that the cingulum, which is a part of the brain that connects ventral areas of prefrontal cortex to amygdala areas right around amygdala, this is showing that you see some diminished integrity in that system in the kids with autism who happen to have anxiety. So this is the sort of boiled down version of that narrative. We know that white matter appears to be abnormal in many people with autism. Say you're the kid with autism who has a white matter abnormality that affects the cingulum, maybe you will be more prone to having anxiety symptoms. Okay, so I'm probably just about out of time. I think we're used to doing studies. You know, you might do a study on 20 or 30 undergraduates, and you know, you might not realize this, but one or two of them may be severely depressed. You know, they'll meet you, and it's not like they're wearing a sign, but it will affect their cognition. And how well an intervention fares in a given population has some relevance to it, and it's probably wise to check it out. And this is something. This is my Kool-Aid that I'm asking you to drink. Anxiety, depression. I just had to, when I made this slide, I realized, well, it's true. You see anxiety and depression in autism, but you see other things. I mean, ADHD is highly comorbid in autism as well, even though you're not allowed yet to formally diagnose it. We have to deal with attentional issues all the time in folks with autism. If you want to get them to learn, they have to be able to focus, one would think. Okay, so I've gotten through most of this and said almost nothing about temporal dynamics. Like I said, I'm a turtle. I'm slow and steady. We don't necessarily know enough about emotions affecting these different parts of the brain. And I think if you look at the field of affective neuroscience, or air quotes, that's something that largely emerged in the 90s. And I think that the time course of emotions affects on these different processes. Just for this talk, I tried to look around, and you find things about these, how amygdala has privileged access to information, which is a theory that's discussed a lot these days. But it's really hard to know the time course of emotions effect on these different processes. And another thing is, of course, how do you put a stopwatch on emotion? This is something I think about all the time. I try to do mood inductions on people. I try them to be upset for like 3 minutes. You know, is that so? That's when emotions happen. Okay. You know, what about an emotional Stroop task? second and a half, have you done a mood induction? It's really hard to, it's a little bit different than sort of constrained behavioral tasks where, you know, you can infer the presence over a certain period of time of a specific outcome because you, they pressed a button or, well, I mean, all these paradigms have difficulties, but it's hard to know what the time course is. So, but the big picture is clear. If you look at school outcomes among kids with depression and anxiety, you see impacts on learning. And, you know, and it's, they can be direct and indirect, admittedly. I mean, there's the impact of cognitive function, but there's the fact that in kids with severe anxiety in particular, that, you know, they'll have a hard time getting to school. You're obviously going to not learn as much if you can't participate. And then, more broadly speaking, on just effects on productivity over longer periods of time. So the slow temporal dynamic is clearer than the fast. Okay, and thank you to everyone here, but I also want to thank the people that aren't here that you may not know. There's a number of people at CHOP, Penn, and other universities working with me on this, on these different projects, and I wanted to thank them, and thank you.
In our conversation analysis, all the typically developing children had strong interaction dynamics with the adult. All the high-functioning autism children with HFA had problems or did not interact, but some talked a lot and didn't respond, and some only responded when spoken to. And it seemed to be consistent within the children that there really were these two groups, and we found some mention of them in the literature, and I'm wondering if you could comment. Are there two groups or two or more groups?
Well, like I said, I'm a lumper, not a splitter. I mean, I'm trying to drill down on the specific phenomena you're talking about. So you're talking about how you found more of a range of participatory language in the high-functioning group and less of a range in everyone else? Is it?
Everyone else. Among the typically developing, mm-hmm. the child's interaction and the adult's interaction were strongly correlated.
Right.
If they both engaged, they both engaged a lot. If they engaged less, they both engaged less. Mm-hmm. With the HFA, there were just two strong groups. One group initiated all the topics. You had to talk about video games, and the adult didn't get a word in edgeways. Otherwise, they didn't initiate any topics at all. So there really were two distinct groups. There wasn't this correlation with the adult. There wasn't this interaction. But there did seem to be two distinct groups, not a range.
On any given day, I might talk myself into or out of those being two distinct categories. I would really like to invoke some sort of regulatory or synchrony mechanism such that perhaps this sort of social synchrony is abnormal in kids, and whether they wind up fast or slow is relevant, but it's determined by some other factor. I guess today I would split that. Today I'm going to split those. I would think that it's a very interesting question. I think what sort of is behind those kids in the spectrum who manage is kind of a loaded term, but who voluntarily speak a lot versus those that are not. I think it's probably an important individual difference, and you probably can group people along those lines. But I'm not sure.
To initiate more, and the adults can't get a word in edgewise, maybe are more likely to have comorbid ADHD.
Hmm. Okay. Well, one of the classic features of autism is monologuing, as we all know as academics. I have another question.
The kids, I'm not sure, we'll have to look at the attentional stuff on those kids, but those kids who were more initiating are the ones who like to go up to people and talk to them. They're just not very good at adapting their conversation to someone else, whereas the other ones really were not so much talkers. I mean, they talked very, very little and were were more asocial. So, and those two personality groups have been described within
yeah.
autism.
Yeah, that goes back to Lorna Wing. Yeah, I mean, I think, and those actually may ultimately prove to stand the test of time as distinct groups of people, and it could be that that's a distinction. In my mind, it's tricky not to rule out other third variables in sort of finding out who falls in those different bins. Yeah, I mean, it could be some kids fall into specific patterns of monologuing or whatnot for reasons that that might not fit neatly into some of these categories. But yeah, it's a very interesting question.
So yeah. With respect to being a lumper and time frame, it will be tough regardless, right? Because I really love the amygdala also. But on the other hand,
oh, <yeah. laughs>
I confess my love for the amygdala. And I'm really excited by a lot of your findings because I think it's too much ignored also. But on the other hand, I mean, the central nucleus has its hands on every neuromodulator. Mm-hmm. It projects to every neuromodulator. And each of those neuromodulators acts on a different time scale
right.
and has a different tonic and immediate effect. Mm-hmm. So that's tough. And we actually don't have the tools yet, actually. Mm-hmm.
That's right. I mean, as soon, there's another thing that occurred to me as I was putting this talk together. As soon as you go one level deeper and get more granular in how these different parts of the brain function, I mean, even if you just look at the subnuclei of the amygdala, the story gets so much more complicated so fast. Absolutely. It's hard to measure these things and intact people. Yeah.
So I have I guess it's an advertisement in the shallow guise of a question, which is that I guess I'm very sympathetic with your problem of trying to make people angry for 2.5 seconds or something like that. I've never tried it. I think one of my sons tries it pretty regularly, but actually it doesn't work on me. But on the other hand, measurement is a different story, and so. You know, tomorrow at 11, there's going to be this session for anyone who's interested on physiological measures during social interactions. So even if you can't manipulate emotions in quite a razor-sharp way, you can get some, or you may be able to get some, and this is one of the questions, fairly temporally sensitive indices of emotional and arousal processes. But okay, so advertisement over. Please join us for that. The question is sort of, you're talking about, you know, the effects of emotion on learning are many and clear, and you know, lots of clearly important questions about effects in education, different clinical groups. But you know, the flip side is learning emotional responses. And you know, from back in grad school, I you know, ever since I've found fascinating the idea of sort of entrainment of emotional control, right? So in attachment theory and so forth, I'm sure you're familiar with this, they talk about, you know, the infant learning from parents is sort of different models and strategies for self-regulation. And so I'm sort of thinking about a chicken egg sort of question with kids with different developmental disorders and what they're not picking up from potentially from caregivers in terms of ways to regulate themselves. So when you talk about the, you know, ontogenesis of some of the comorbid anxiety disorders and conditions, how much of that is stuff that's not sort of getting regulated out that effectively because the early social interactions may be disordered? I'm wondering if you can speak to that.
Yes. I think the part of, you know, one of the more interesting implications of, you know, data from, like, well, I guess it's been 20 years now, about how the prefrontal cortex continues to develop through adolescence, right? We continue and are constantly developing mechanisms by which we can regulate our own emotion, and we, from modeling, from, and yes, and it's actually, it's absolutely a reciprocal process, and you can imagine if you, you know, how hamstrung you would be if you started out life not being able to focus enough to learn from the people around you those effortful ways of regulating your own emotion. So there's you know, both effortful and automatic ways people regulate their emotion practically every second. And we're very used to using those. And yeah, it's a very reciprocal process.
Yeah, I guess I want to follow up on the chicken and eggness. So that you sort of just took that in that direction, that the arousal mechanisms can quite likely, as you suggested, modulate our sensory receptivity. And, you know, in fact, we're working on a sensory grant on that very thing, why we're all meeting to figure out how these psychophysiological measures work. But so if you're in a state where, you know, you've got some sort of funky arousal mechanism, so here's the chicken and egg. What comes first? Is that is the emotion disrupted, or is there an arousal system that's disrupted, and that also, you know, makes your sensory experiences extraordinarily unpleasant? And as you know, my personal favorite story is that your motor system's kind of busted, and your sampling of the environment doesn't work all that well, and so you're not actually getting accurate data to begin with, and that might make one sad or anxious, actually. And so,
right.
It's just this. How do we try to tease those things apart?
Yeah, I don't know. a couple follow-up points there. We are able to measure various indices of arousal with fairly good resolution. Arousal, the lie detector test has been around for how long, right? and a cop can do it. You know, I've had the hardest time measuring good skin conductance, and I'm like, why? It can be an elusive measure sometimes. But there's a lot in the affective neuroscience field. This whole topic of emotion regulation is one that I've always struggled with, because if you sort of follow the trends in the field of emotion research, there's research about emotion, and then, there's always talk about regulation, but then there was, the people that studied emotion regulation as if it was some different thing than the emotion. And I've always had such a hard time with that. I don't know, and I don't always know when I should stop playing that game about what came first. It could be an infinite loop. There are clearly antecedents to negative experiences, and they're obvious in life, and they may happen over a very short span of time, but they're so interdigitated. You are constantly, the idea of having an emotional experience without some regulatory mechanism. We're talking what, decorticate? It's hard. It's a very hard thing to do. So I stand with my original answer. I don't know. Sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They're part of the same system. Right. Well, the thing about a cycle is you can intervene in lots of places in the cycle, right? And disrupt it.
Have you considered the role of sleep disturbances in emotional regulation? This community, and the different phenotypes.
This is actually a colleague of mine just got a grant from the Department of Defense. It always amazes me to study sleep disturbances in autism, and this is something actually in that sample of 58 people. At the same time, my colleague, her name's Margaret Souders, she's a PhD and a nurse practitioner who has years of experience working with sleep disorders. She did a sleep assessment of each of those 58 kids. I think with one exception, every single kid that had an anxiety disorder had a sleep problem. So talk about arousal dysregulation. If you haven't slept properly for years, as some parents will appreciate, it's it's actually, and this is, it's a very interesting area, and I know that, for example, in Autism Speaks, the Autism Treatment Network involved in Autism Speaks has taken an interest in this. And this is, it's a very interesting topic in autism, but it's all over the place, sleep in these kids.
This would be a very hard thing to have quantitative data on, but I'm really curious what happens, or do we know anything about what happens in the brain when people spontaneously recover from these kind of things?
From which?
From depression and anxiety.
Spontaneously recover. There's plenty of treatment studies, and I could talk about those. The spontaneous piece, I don't know of any data in depression and anxiety on that. Very interesting question. What I know is the treatment studies, which is you tend to see upregulation of prefrontal cortex regions in successful treatment of depression and anxiety, and for exactly the reasons we've been talking about. Probably an increased regulatory capacity of some kind. Anterior cingulate is something that you see a lot in this context. But spontaneous, it's a really good question. That's I would like to know the answer to that question. Yeah.
Related to the sleep question, what about circadian? Is there any overlaid circadian information that you can talk about?
I think the answer is yes. That is outside of what I know, and I think actually that's exactly what my colleague is curious about. And again, I'm outside my league here, but I mean she as part of her intervention, she uses things like melatonin and other medications to try to get that back on balance. But I don't know that much about it, but.
Relating to serotonin problem in these children with sleep disorders, autism.
It makes sense. It fits.